Today is January the 5th, 2022. Last year, 2021, was a tough year. But in 2022, we are looking forward to returning to the studio to do live shows and taking your phone calls. And when is that? Well, hopefully soon. We thank you, the listeners, for your continued support. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. If you have had problems signing on to prn.fm, try prn.live. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. There is a Cold War. In this case, it's not military arms, but semiconductor chips. Alibaba, Tencent, and Xiaomi pledged to make China a global chip leader, to help make China a self-reliant technology superpower. The ruling Communist Party is pushing the world's biggest e-commerce company, Alibaba Group, to take on the tricky, expensive business of designing its own processor chips, a business unlike anything Alibaba Group has done before. Its three-year-old chip unit, T-Head, unveiled its third processor in October, the Yetian 710 for Alibaba's cloud computing business. Alibaba says for now it has no plans to sell the chip to outsiders. Other new chip developers, including Tencent, a games and social media giant, and smartphone brand Xiaomi, are pledging billions of dollars in line with official plans to create computing, clean energy, and other technology that can build China's wealth and global influence. Processor chips play an increasingly critical role in products from smartphones and cars to medical devices and home appliances. Shortages due to the coronavirus pandemic are disrupting global manufacturing and adding to worries about supplies. Chips are a top priority in the ruling Communist Party's marathon campaign to end China's reliance on technology from the United States, Japan, and other suppliers, whom Beijing sees as potential economic and strategic rivals. If China succeeds, business and political leaders warn that might slow down innovation and disrupt global trade. Self-reliance is the foundation for the Chinese nation. President Xi Jinping called for China to become a technology superpower to safeguard national economic security and to become the world's main center of science and the high ground for innovation. Even with huge official investments, business people and analysts say chip makers and other companies will struggle to compete if they detach from global suppliers of advanced components and technology. It's hard to imagine any one country rebuilding all that and having the best technology. Beijing's campaign is adding to tension with Washington and Europe, which see China as a strategic competitor and complain it steals technology. If the world were to decouple or split into markets with incompatible standards and products, United States or European-made parts might not work in Chinese computers or cars. Smartphone makers who have a single dominant global operating system and two network standards might need to make unique versions for different markets. That could slow down development. Washington and Beijing need to avoid that the world becomes separated. China's factories assemble the world's smartphones and tablet computers, but need components from the United States, Europe, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. Chips are China's biggest import, ahead of crude oil, of more than $300 billion last year. Official urgency over that grew over Huawei Technologies Limited, China's first global tech brand, when it lost access to U.S. chips and other technology in 2018 under sanctions imposed by the White House. That crippled the telecom equipment maker's ambition to be a leader in next-generation smartphones. American officials say Huawei is a security risk and might aid Chinese spying, an accusation the company denies. Huawei and some Chinese rivals are close to matching Intel, Qualcomm, and Britain's Arm Limited at being able to design leading-edge logic chips for smartphones. But when it comes to making them, foundries such as state-owned SMIC in Shanghai are up to a decade behind industry leaders, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, which produces chips for Apple Inc. and other global brands. Even companies such as Alibaba that can design chips likely will need Taiwanese or other foreign foundries to make them. Alibaba's Yetian 710 requires precision no Chinese foundry can achieve. The company declined to say which foreign producer it will use. Packing millions of transistors onto a fingernail-sized sliver of silicon requires some 1,500 steps. Microscopic precision and technologies owned by a handful of U.S., European, Japanese, and other suppliers. China lacks significant tools, materials, and production technology. Washington and Europe, citing security worries, block access to the most advanced tools Chinese chipmakers need to match global leaders in precision and efficiency. Without those, China is falling further behind. Washington stepped up pressure on Huawei last year by barring global foundries from using American technology to produce its chips. U.S. vendors can sell chips to the company, but not for next-generation 5G smartphones. For its part, the European Union said it will review foreign investments after complaints China was eroding Europe's technology lead by purchasing important assets such as German's robot maker KUKA. Alibaba's Yetian 710 is based on architecture from Britain's Arm, highlighting China's enduring need for foreign know-how. Alibaba said it still will work closely with longtime foreign suppliers Intel, Arm, NVIDIA, and Advanced Micro Devices, Inc. T-Head, their first chip, the Huawang 800, was announced in 2019 for artificial intelligence. Its second, the Huantai 910, is for self-driving cars and other functions. Beijing says it will spend $150 billion from 2014 through 2030 to develop its chip industry. But even that is only a fraction of what global leaders invest. Taiwan Semiconductor plans to spend $100 billion in the next 3 years on research and manufacturing. China is trying to buy experience by hiring engineers from Taiwan Semiconductor and other Taiwanese producers. Taiwan, which Beijing claims as part of its territory and has threatened to attack, has responded by imposing curbs on job advertising. Beijing encourages smartphone and other manufacturers to use suppliers within China, even if they cost more. But officials deny China wants to detach from global industries. The latest conflict is over photolithography, which uses ultraviolet light to etch circuits into silicon on a scale measured in nanometers or billionths of a meter. The leader is ASML in the Netherlands, which makes machines that can etch transistors just 9 nanometers apart. That would pack 2 million into a space 1 centimeter wide. China's SMIC foundry is only about one-third as precise at 14 nanometers. Taiwan's semiconductor is preparing to increase its precision to 2 nanometers. SMIC wants to upgrade by purchasing ASML's latest machine. But the Dutch government has yet to agree. So we have a Cold War, and in this case, it's not military arms, but semiconductor chips. More people are using Android apps on Chromebooks. The Android app experience on large screen devices isn't ideal. Google is sharing some data and highlighting helpful tools for developers to adjust Android apps on Chromebooks, and app engagement on Chromebooks is up 50%. Here's what Google says. More people are craving their favorite smartphone experiences on large screen devices, such as Chromebooks, tablets, and foldables. On Chromebooks alone, the number of users engaging with Android apps increased 50% year over year. The figures come from Google's internal metrics, so we have no reason to doubt that number. For many, Android apps are a very secondary experience, not the primary reason why people buy a Chrome OS device. Then again, this metric measures users engaging with Android apps. That means it counts whether someone uses Android software every day on their Chromebook or just once. Still, it's promising for Chromebooks as a whole, and particularly for makers of Android apps. While Google itself can't address every Android app experience on a Chromebook, it can provide help. On Chrome OS, native apps are cloud-based. This means productivity apps like Gmail and Google Docs live and store items in the cloud. Newer Chromebooks also support Android apps downloaded via the Google Play Store. This opens up a wide range of possibilities with millions of productivity apps and games available. Both web apps and Android apps support shortcuts and are easily accessed via the launcher. Whether you're looking for familiar social media apps or mobile games, Android apps offer something for everyone. So let's take a look on how to get started with Android apps on Chrome OS. First, we have to find out if your Chromebook is compatible with Android apps. If your Chromebook supports the Google Play Store, you will see a Google Play Store option. This means you can run Android apps on your Chromebook. Some older Chromebooks didn't ship with Google Play support enabled by default. However, many of those devices receive Android app support via an update. If you have an older Chromebook, you should check for updates if you don't see the Google Play Store option available. If your Chromebook doesn't support Android apps, it's probably worth upgrading to one of your favorite new Chromebooks. If your Chromebook does support Android apps, the Google Play Store should be enabled by default. In the rare case the option isn't on already, you can choose to turn on the enable option to run Android apps. Note that not all Android apps are optimized for Chromebooks. Most popular social media, productivity, and media apps are optimized, but there are exceptions. It's easy to tell if an app is not optimized for Chromebooks. You'll notice that the app still runs in a window the size of a phone screen. VIA to cease chip development. Who is VIA? VIA, that's V-I-A, has produced multiple x86-compatible CPUs through its acquisition of Cyrex and Centaur Technology. VIA produces CPUs through the Chaozin joint venture. Many of the CPUs are Borg grid array chips sold pre-soldered onto a motherboard. VIA Technologies is one of the largest manufacturers of computer chipsets and the ITX motherboard. VIA CPUs are installed in many white box PC clones. One of their business units is Centaur Technologies, Inc. Centaur developed compatible x86 processors that are much less expensive than Intel processors and consume much less power. In September of 1999, Centaur, based in Austin, Texas, was purchased by VIA Technologies, a Taiwanese company. Since then, in November, just last year, Intel recruited some of the employees of the Centaur Technology division from VIA, a deal worth $125 million, and effectively acquiring the talent and know-how of the x86 division. It is not clear what will happen with the x86 license held by VIA. Essentially, this means that the company is shutting down the site and ending chip development operations in the United States. For Intel, it makes more sense to add the developers from Centaur to its existing teams. For VIA, it no longer made sense to keep expensive chip development in the United States. Centaur Technology developed a number of microarchitectures which later were used for CPUs designed by Chaozin, that's in China. At some point, Vi understood that it might be lucrative to sell off its Centaur development team for $125 million and preserve its right to develop, build, and sell x86 processors, retain its CPU-related patents, and keep some engineers. Meanwhile, it does not look like it will continue to design CPUs in the United States, but rather focus on its Chaozin joint venture. New FCC program helps pay for internet. A new program will provide low-income families with subsidies to help cover the cost of internet service, as well as provide money for devices such as laptops and tablets. The Federal Communications Commission's Affordable Connectivity Program offers $30 per month towards internet services through a qualified provider. Eligible households can also receive a one-time discount of up to $100 to purchase a laptop, desktop computer, or tablet from a participating provider if they contribute at least $10 or less than $50 towards the purchase. The program is the $14.2 billion successor to the emergency broadband benefit that provided a subsidy of up to $50 a month for internet services. That program, which ended December the 31st, provided services to 9 million families. The response to the emergency broadband benefit proved that what many knew to be true. The cost of high-speed internet is out of reach for too many of us, said FCC Chairwoman Rosen Wassel. Now with a long-term affordable connectivity program, we have the opportunity to enroll even more households and help ensure they can afford the internet connections they need for work, school, healthcare, and more for years. To be eligible, families must qualify for the following. Have income at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. Participate in assistance programs such as SNAP, Medicaid, Federal Public Housing Assistance, SSI, WIC, or Lifeline. Participate in tribal-specific programs such as the Bureau of Indian Affairs, General Assistance, Tribal TANF, or Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations. Be approved to receive benefits under the Free and Reduced Price School Lunch Program or the School Breakfast Program, including through the USDA Community Eligibility Provisions in the 2019 to 2020 the 2020 to the 2021, or the 2021 to the 2022 school year, have received a federal Pell Grant during the current award year, or meet the eligibility criteria for a participating provider's existing low-income program. For more information, go to the website fcc.gov/ACP. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Complaints for IT, Part 1 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we set aside a little bit of time to talk about you and how you interact with tech at the workplace. That, at least that's what we're going to do for this 5-part series. And I want to start off by saying that I'm going to give you both sides of this. I am not going to necessarily defend IT all the way. I am an IT professional. I have been for, we'll just say, a long time. And this is probably one of the biggest complaints I've ever heard. And I continue to hear it to this day. It's all about the... I'm going to use a negative phrase here. The helpless desk. Oh, yes, we've all dealt with it. We call on up and we know before we even dial the phone that this is going to be a nightmare. This is going to be like pulling teeth. And that actually is starting off the entire journey with what is essentially a customer service kind of situation, but we're already starting it off angry, upset, unhappy, and mad. One of the biggest things that I'm going to give you first before we go in is that, yes, there are problems with some of the help desks. There are problems with dealing with some of the people on the other end. And some of those have to do with language barriers. And some of those is, okay, look, you may have heard there was this little thing, little small building they made, you know, back in the Old Testament called the Tower of Babel, where, yes, everybody's language was confused. Well, that continues to this day. We still struggle with being able to put forth the words that are inside of our head and inside of our heart and present them to other people. Just ask any married couple. So now all of a sudden you're going to call someone up and you're already mad because your computer is not working. You're already mad because the last time they did it, they said, oh, did you reboot your computer? And you did, and it worked. All right, so let's go into this. The help desk, we've renamed it service desk and IT service management and things like this. The help desk really is there for you. The more patience that you have with them, the greater that they're going to be able to, the greater of a chance that they're going to be able to sort things out for you, to put things together back the way they were. Now, I know this is stressful, and I would encourage you before you call up whatever support desk name, tech desk, they've got so many different names, go and get a cup of chamomile tea. No, not coffee. Don't drink a Red Bull. Don't get hyped up on caffeine. I want you to just chill. I want you to relax. If you're a smoker, go have a cigarette. If you are, well, you're not supposed to drink at work, but you know, anything that you can do at work, go ahead and do that to just get into a nice relaxed mode. Now, the support desk on the other end, they have to interpret whatever it is you're saying. So I want you to know that they do have a certain level of frustration. And they have to interpret whatever it is that you're giving to them as far as knowledge. And it's always limited knowledge. And sometimes it's jaundiced. It's biased. It's somehow affected by your experience today, but over the course of your tech lifetime. So you want to give them as much leeway as you can. They're going to try to figure out whatever it is that's going wrong. And sometimes, yes, you may wind up with a technician that it feels like all they're doing is they're just writing in a ticket. And that's okay, because the last caller may have called up and may have been screaming and yelling and just, you know, just destroying their entire psyche. And we have to understand, we're not the only people there. And you say get a thicker skin, but you know, I will tell you that I have worked a service desk and I have heard various words strung together in very creative ways that I would have never imagined them putting together that many of the words that I would normally never say, if you get my drift. So you don't know what's happening. So I want you to give them as much leeway as you can. And I know, I mean, this is a big complaint. You complain about that they didn't handle my problem right to now. Well, they will. That's what that whole ticketing software is for. It's to make sure that they're tracking everything. And yes, they may have had a bad day. And whatever you can do to brighten their day, to make their day easier, is going to make your day easier. You will win friends with a service desk. I will tell you, if you go, you know what, I'm sorry to call you up, and I know you probably have had a rough day. This is my problem. You know, if we can solve it, great. If you can send somebody out later, that's fine. I'm easygoing. If you tell them that, do you know where you get put on the list? Oddly enough, you don't get put at the bottom. Usually, you get put at the top. Hey, Joe, you're having a bad day, right? Look, I'm going to give you an easy one. Marcy, she needs some help, and she's really easygoing today. Why don't you go help her? Take a break, take a load off, and it's going to be a simple fix. See how that works? Yeah, the nicer you are to them, the more likely that they will ramp you up versus trample over you. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The James Webb Space Telescope. As they described it, hunky-dory after problems were fixed. The tennis court-sized sun shield on the James Webb Space Telescope is now fully open and in the process of being stretched tight. The James Webb Space Telescope was launched on Saturday, Christmas Day, December the 25th. NASA's James Webb Space Telescope soared from French Guiana on South America's northeastern coast, riding a European Ariane rocket into the Christmas morning sky. The $10 billion infrared observatory is intended as the successor to the aging Hubble Space Telescope. NASA's new space telescope is on the verge of completing the riskiest part of its mission, unfolding and tightening a huge sunshield. Officials said on Monday, ground controllers fixed a pair of problems. The tennis court-sized sunshield on the James Webb Space Telescope is now fully open and in the process of being stretched tight. The $10 billion telescope, the largest and most powerful astronomical observatory ever launched, rocketed away Christmas Day from French Guiana. Its sun shield and primary mirror had to be folded to fit into the European Ariane rocket. The sun shield is vital for keeping Webb's infrared sensing instruments at sub-zero temperatures as they scan the universe for the first stars and galaxies and examine the atmosphere of alien worlds for possible signs of life. Getting the sun shield extended last Friday was really a huge achievement, said the project manager, and all 107 release pins opened properly. But there had been a few obstacles. Flight controllers in Maryland had to reset Webb's solar panel to draw more power. The observatory, considered the successor to the aging Hubble Space Telescope, was never in danger, though, with a constant power flow, said a lead engineer for the telescope's prime contractor, Northrop Grumman. They also repointed the telescope to limit sunlight on 6 overheating motors. The motors cooled enough to begin securing the sunshield. NASA said, "Everything is hunky-doring and doing well now." The James Webb Telescope should reach its destination 1 million miles. That's 1.6 million kilometers away by the end of January. As of Monday, the telescope was more than halfway there. The infrared telescope should begin observing the cosmos by the end of June, ultimately unveiling the first stars and galaxies formed in the universe 13.7 billion years ago. That's a mere 100 million years after the universe created the Big Bang. Launched in 1990, Hubble, which sees primarily visible light, has peered as far back as 13.4 billion years ago. Astronomers hope to close the gap with the Webb, which is 100 times more powerful. In another bit of good news Monday, officials said they expect the Webb telescope to last well beyond the original anticipated 10 years based on its fuel efficiency. All went well and it was hunky-dory. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Switching from AT&T to T-Mobile.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, I understand.
Yes.
That you've had a change in your cell phone. Tell me what's going on there.
Well, I divorced AT&T is what happened.
Did you have to go to divorce court?
I just had to go to T-Mobile. They handled so much. It was terrific.
Nice.
There's no alimony. In fact, it's a reverse alimony that way. I'll get into that.
Okay.
I started with Verizon. Mm-hmm. And we go to trade shows. We meet those people. Lovely people. I always like the people from Verizon. but I really never liked the service. You had great service. I had terrible experience.
I've always had just absolutely amazing wherever I've gone. I've had people go, do you have any signal? Oh yeah, I'm perfectly fine. But okay, so Southern California.
Maybe it's that long wire you tow along with.
Yeah, there is that. Southern California is very difficult and very tricky with all of the hills and all of the different geography that's around. Verizon really, focused heavily on Southern California, and that's what I was exposed to.
Now, the rest of the country. If you ever travel to, distant Chicago, you'll find that getting any of the carriers permission to put their towers on those buildings is not like pulling teeth, like regrowing teeth. So there are lots of signal wells there. But I wanted to leave Verizon.
Sure, yeah.
I looked at Sprint, which had only stopped being GTE a few seconds earlier, and I never.
Okay, so that goes back a few years.
Yeah. And I was never really under the impression that, they understood what it took to be a cell phone company. Now, maybe that's unfair of me, but it was always, in my mind, the amateur play in the group.
I've stopped watching Sprint probably a decade ago, but up until a decade ago, they were kind of that, what do I want to say? I want to say kind of like that knockoff Radio Shack that was in the middle of nowhere and didn't carry anywhere near the amount of stuff that a normal Radio Shack would.
And also had a section for bait.
Yes. I remember that. There was bait and there was ammo and, snacks.
I looked at AT&T, and in that era, AT&T was my choice. Sprint, by the way, is now owned by T-Mobile. And what is fun about that is that T-Mobile added low band. And low band follows the curvature of the earth. And as a result, as nice as Verizon is in their coverage, T-Mobile signals and their 5G mix of bands goes in places that otherwise don't get coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I went to T-Mobile. I said, look, if I want to switch, what can you do for? And I should mention, I'm married to a lady who really was starting to object to AT&T politics and would have been quite delighted and was quite delighted when I changed.
Okay.
So, everything's a factor when you're doing this stuff. I went to T-Mobile. I said, what can you do for me? And they said, well, you're a senior. I said, yes. They said, are you a veteran? I said, yes. I get free donuts on Veterans Day, free breakfast, a free haircut. Sure. It's all fun.
Yeah.
In fact, here's my great clips. You guys who are watching on TV can't see this. My great clips free haircut card.
Watching on TV, I'm glad we don't have television. They don't want to see my face. All right, go on.
I don't know. It's so upside down with all the hair on the bottom. And anyway, I said, T-Mobile, what can you do? And the first thing they showed me was a package that was a better package than I had at $100 less.
Okay, that's a good idea.
A nice chunk of change. And I said, look, I still have to pay off these phones. I just got a check for more or less $900. They paid off what I owed AT&T on two phones.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now I've gone in, and they're taking my Google Pixel 5 as a trade-in.
Mm-hmm.
Google Pixel 6 Pro, and I think it covers everything. The full amount of that trade up.
Okay.
And my wife has a Samsung Galaxy S9, but I had retired a Samsung Galaxy S10, which is worth more as a trade in. So that S10 goes to them so she can get an S21 Plus. And they threw in a free Galaxy Watch.
Oh, nice. Wow. I mean, they're really working for your business there. That is amazing.
Well, I'm sure that Google and Galaxy and Samsung and so on are helping with that effort.
Sure, yeah. So there was a lot of stuff that went good. Any bad? Anything that was?
Well, every once in a while, the aging Marty makes a goof.
Yeah.
And as you know, I work from my basement when I'm not out somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And working from the basement, I wondered why the signal was so bad.
Yeah.
And after a day, it just occurred to me, wait a minute, do I have to go in and reactivate Wi-Fi calling?
Okay, there is that. Yeah.
and when I did, everything got solved.
Oh, beautiful. That is, you know, that's, it's very interesting. I have been occasionally, tempted to look into switching, into changing. I think I'll pay a little bit more attention to that in the coming months.
We might also add, it might be one of the few areas in Christmas gifts where there's still supplies available.
Very true. This is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hey, Marty, when you divorced from ATT Services, were there any prenups? Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. DuckDuckGo Preview's desktop web browser. Fans of DuckDuckGo are probably familiar with the company's mobile web browser, but there's a desktop version coming out this year, and DuckDuckGo just offered a short preview in a post highlighting its privacy accomplishments over the past year. DuckDuckGo said the desktop version will redefine user expectations of everyday online privacy. DuckDuckGo has no complicated settings, no misleading warnings, no levels of privacy protection, just robust privacy protection that works by default across search, browsing, email, and more. They said it's not a privacy browser. It's an everyday browsing app that respects your privacy because there's never a bad time to stop companies from spying on your search and browsing history. Well, according to DuckDuckGo, the desktop web browser is not built on Chromium, which will be troubling to some and celebrated by others. Instead, the browser is built around the operating system provided rendering engines, like on mobile, allowing them to strip away a lot of the unnecessary clutter that's accumulated over the years in major browsers. The browser will also feature a clean and simple interface and the popular Fire button from DuckDuckGo's mobile app. Compared to Chrome, the DuckDuckGo app for desktop is cleaner and more private, and early tests have found it significantly faster too. DuckDuckGo says a timeline for its release, however, is unclear. As for DuckDuckGo's privacy accomplishments in 2021, they said that improvements to its search, tracker blocking, and mobile app, plus new features like email protection and app tracking protection have helped establish it as the go-to solution for privacy protection online. They are building a simple privacy layer for how people use the internet today without any trade-offs. They said it's privacy simplified. And the firm has seen some real success too. DuckDuckGo is now the most downloaded web browser app on Android in what it describes as its major markets, and it is number 2 on iOS behind Chrome. DuckDuckGo now averages more than 100 million searches each day, and its most recent survey shows that 27 million Americans, that's about 9% of the population, use DuckDuckGo. The firm has seen over 150 million downloads on its privacy apps and extensions since 2018 worldwide. If you haven't tried DuckDuckGo, give it a try. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Ben and Marty wrapping up the year with first look at different products.
Marty Winston's here to tell us about some of the things that are on the shelves, some of the things that are a little bit more readily available. Maybe some of these I know are going to be a little bit less nerdy. I know that, Marty, you've got a lot of friends in the tool industry.
Yeah.
Klein Tools is a favorite of yours.
And you of them.
Yes. So let's talk about some of the different things that are out there. Yeah.
Well, the hand tools are a good starting point, and there's a brand that you haven't heard of in forever. Oh, I'm leaning over to pick up a box from Channel Lock.
Okay. Yeah. The original Channel Lock.
This is a Channel Lock player that I'm holding up.
Yeah.
Stare at your radio. You may be able to see it. And it's got their little push button thing at the hinge, so you're never going to slip from the position you set it to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the brand secret, and it's an absolute love. And this is now available with some really new features in three different sizes, cushion grips, and extra features like laser-treated edges that can ream pipes that you're working on, that kind of thing. So that is to love for anybody who ever has to grab and turn with more than human strength. Also from Channel Lock, 7.5-inch forged wire stripper. And I'm going to hold this up so Ben can see it and tell you a little bit about it. If I can do it with, there we go. Have a look at this thing.
Oh, nice. You know, I've had so many wire strippers over the years, and they've always been just pieces of junk.
Yeah.
And this is distinctly, I can tell just looking over the camera at this, that it is distinctly a higher quality and definitely far better made than the wire strippers I've had.
Very much. Red button lock on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's marked in ways that I think will never rub off for both threaded and solid sizes to strip. There's another reamer at the end for going into conduit. The point is not the broad point you've seen in so many recent things, but a nicely narrow one. And it's got screw cutters for the popular screw sizes on the side.
Yeah, yeah.
I have this.
So I think one of the things you're trying to say here is start looking more at the quality of the items.
Now, Klein Tools, our good friends, sent, and again, Ben's on camera, a set of five insulated shank drivers with very long shanks.
Yeah.
And very small heads. So they work on the practical screws you worry about, and they work when you have to pass by things that might otherwise zap you.
You know, I've been replacing some switches in the house, and those would have come in handy.
Yeah. And it even includes a little tip magnetizer tool for you.
Nice, yeah.
So that's interesting. For anyone who ever works with Cat 5, Cat 6 cable, these new Klein Tool pass-through connectors skip a huge step. I've got both STP and UTP shielded and unshielded.
Sure.
And it's, you don't have to cut it even and then push them in just right. You pass it through and they're already in order. It's
that's amazing stuff. Now, I've seen pass-through connectors before, but I'll tell you, if Klein Tools is doing it, they're doing it right. They've refined out some of the problems. So, yeah, okay. I'm excited by that.
I'm going to show Ben something that you don't get to buy that I got, and it's like a candy box for a geek.
Okay. All right.
This is from CIT. They make switches and relays. And when you're designing products, as I've been doing a bit of.
That's just so awesome. Oh, look. Okay. So I see some of the lever switches. I see some a number of relays. This is all filled with – this is a box. So what is this? This is a sample box for their for their sales guys? That is
amazing.
Well,
they don't even give it to all their sales guys. It's got board-mounted and free-mounted push switches, rocker switches, illuminated push buttons, relays, micro switches. Wow. Oops, that's a different brand. And when they sent this to me, I was so honored. We sat in a meeting, and their head of sales said, you know, we don't even give these to all of our salesmen, but you're the kind of guy who would really – you've really got to have it.
I am geeking out over that. That is my inner 12-year-old is going, oh, I could do so many things. I would put that one there, and I would do that, and I would – they're just like, oh, yeah.
Exactly. From Klein Tools, one of which – takes the voltage of a USB connection so you can determine whether it really is getting those fast chargers to happen.
Nice.
And the other is a little red light you can stick on with a magnet to a clip to a hard hat, for example.
Sure, yeah.
So working in the dark or in a dangerous place, people know where you are and where you're not and all that stuff.
So I like the way that it's glowing. It's got like a Cylon Warrior kind of...
Well, how do you know it isn't?
Professor John Hammond made a T-Rex in Jurassic Park.
My T-Rex is from Amaze Fit.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you know, I'm about as close to fitness as you are to the South Pole.
That's a pretty far distance. Okay, go on.
So I pay no attention to the fact that it's counting steps and it can do all the exercise routine and calorie stuff and all of that other fitness mm-hmm. stuff that everybody buys Fitbits for. I got it because I wanted a watch that I could read, you know, even in bed. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the watches, you got to charge all night. You want to know what time it is when you just open your eyes for a minute? That watch isn't there.
You know, okay, so I'm right there with you. I have worn a watch to bed for 24/7. I wear watches. I take it off about once a week to in the shower. Because okay. I wear it in the shower. I take it off in the shower just to watch underneath and make sure my skin is clean and all of that. That's it.
Well, that I better watch you.
So yeah, okay.
What impressed me about this watch is they claimed a 20-day battery life.
What? I'm 20 days? Nearly 3 weeks.
That's probably if you never look at it. I mean, I'm getting 6 or 8 pretty easily.
Okay. Well, even at 6 or 8, that's in the original Pebble territory, which that was. I had a Pebble watch. I enjoyed that because it had the time, you know, that week long charge. And then everybody's pushing the idea of, oh, you only need to charge it. You get 20 hours of life out of this. No, I don't want 20 hours.
And by the way, these come with those vinyl bands.
Yeah.
And I went and I bought a metal.
Sure.
Band.
Sure. Of course. Yeah.
So if you've got somebody in your family or among your friends who has a Fitbit or something else with a band that is less than superb, buy them a band. That's a pretty good gift.
Yeah.
I found my favorite headset ever.
Yeah.
It is a Aftershocks OpenCom.
Aftershocks, the bone induction.
Bone conduction, right. Conduction. It doesn't cover your ear. It goes in the bone right in front of your ear. I call it a sideburn.
Okay, yeah.
And it has a remarkably good noise-canceling mic.
Mm-hmm, all right.
So the audio quality is superb. You know, after a full day, it's down to battery charge medium instead of high.
Okay.
And it doesn't take long at all, and it also has one of those, I don't know about you, so many things have those magnetic charge connectors that make sure it's aligned correctly and polarized correctly. And at the same time, you go back to where you have the chargers, and those things have made it with each other. I mean, they're
intertwined, yeah, unbelievably, yeah, okay.
Kissy, what are you going to do? I changed from Samsung because I was tired of batteries blowing up mm-hmm. to a Pixel 5.
Yeah, okay.
And I have ordered a Pixel 6 Pro, which mm-hmm. does everything the Pixel 5 does and more. They've got their own CPU now, which is incredible. The charging can be a lot faster because they follow the EPP profile. So even with wireless charging, they can throw 15, 20, 25 watts into charging the phone.
Yeah.
Its camera is one of those things where I'm never going to see all those dots.
Yeah, the cameras are getting a little bit wild these days. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's fabulous, and I've already asked OtterBox to send their case for it. Their charger for it, their new mm-hmm. charging stand, Gen 2. Mm-hmm. First charging stand, you'll see that it's got a fan in the bottom. They're running it really quietly. But it provides not only all the charge flow that you can ask for that 6 Pro.
Sure.
It's also got a USB port on the back for charging something else like your headphone or your watch.
Nice. Okay. I like that.
And I understand, I haven't seen yet, that there's a Google Pixel Watch about to launch.
Ooh, okay. You were just talking about the Amazfit watch, and now you're moving on to the Google Pixel watch. Okay.
I know, I'm so unfaithful.
Well, the reality is, you, like I, you appreciate a lot of the different bells and whistles that come along with this, and we change out our various tech a lot more frequently because we are nerdy, because we're geeky, because we are passionate about the experience.
Or because we can get them for free.
Well, yeah, okay, so that's something. Yeah, we do get a few review units here on the show. Hey,
everybody, I didn't. I bought this stuff. I know it took me a lot of time to have that change of behavior manifest itself. I got lucky. I found a couple extra penny rolls and made it all work.
Oh man! So there's a lot. There's a lot of different things. Again, the supply chain is still kind of
tight,
quirky. So yeah. Rely on stuff you can get in hand. You know, especially if it's a gift. Don't take promises.
Indeed not. And I will point out, phone stores are short too.
Yeah. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th. 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, January the 6th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, January the 7th, 2022, at 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, January 13th, 2022, at 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 14th, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, January the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. It's a virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is pcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.